Soy uno.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen, you live from Rochester, New York, via the Paranormal Radio Network, and also on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. For more information on the show and on my guests, visit our website at www.keyholepublishing.com. Thanks for joining me this evening. As always, I want to hear from you. If you're listening live tonight, join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com to join us in the virtual auditorium. You can participate in the conversation there through instant messaging, or you can also email me with your questions and comments anytime at kdolan@rochester.rr.com. You can also call into the show toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. And if you missed any of that, it's all on the webpage at keyholepublishing.com. My guest this evening is someone that probably a lot of you are familiar with, and if you've only listened to my show, you may or may not know very much about him in particular, and I'm looking forward to having a little chat with him this evening. My producer, Joe Montaldo, has been running Paranormal Radio Network for years now. He got me involved. I've been doing this for a year and a half. And aside from that, he's also a prominent member of ICAR, which is an alien abduction research organization. He's going to be speaking at a couple of upcoming conferences in April 2009 at the Ozark Conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and also at the X Conference put on by Steve Bassett in the Washington, D.C. area. So we have a lot to talk about this evening. Joe, can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, you sound excellent this evening.
Okay, great. Hey, good job, Joe, because you're the one doing the sound.
Hey, I actually tested out a new headset on your show tonight. So well, I've been getting complaints about it. Everybody said I've been needing a new phone, and the only thing I could think is that I got rid of my old headset, so we're going to try a new one tonight. And see. So I hope everybody who's listening to us can hear good tonight. You know, too, I'm going to be lecturing in Gulf Breeze, Florida in 2 weeks. Three weeks, but I have to look at the schedule. So.
Oh, you are? Is that must be before the Ozark Conference.
Yeah, that's actually still in March. That's the last weekend of March, actually, is when it is.
Okay.
I'll be down there in Santa Rosa Island lecturing on alien abductions and some of the activity that we've registered in Gulf Breeze over the last decade and some of the experiences. And there'll be a few contactees that are all be down there with us. So y'all should come check that one out. That should be interesting. There'll probably be 400 or 500 people there, so... come on down, check it out. I'll post it. The information for that will be posted to the site sometime in the next month, so y'all can come check. I mean, in the next week, y'all can come check that out. Also, sometime this week, there'll be a list of radio appearances I'm making between now and the X Conference, which is, well, we'll deduct this one off. So it was a total of 17, so now it's a total of 16. So I'm going to just irritate the daylights out of everybody for the next 5 weeks.
Wow. Well, Joe, I'm really looking forward to having a chance actually to sit and talk. You know, we get to chat every once in a while before or after the show or during the break, but I haven't really had a chance to sit down and talk to you about all the things that you do. And by the way, I forgot to mention, in addition to running the Paranormal Radio Network, you also host your own show, UFO Undercover. And how long have you been doing that show?
UFO Undercover, I've been a host for 7 years, UFO Undercover for a little over 2 years. When I left Wake Up USA, I was with Wake Up USA for 5 years, and then now I host UFO Undercover for the last 2. So I've been 7 years total. We'll say that. 7 years in ufology radio. How's that?
Wow.
And so actually, it does quite well, Tom. I'm quite happy. I know almost everybody in ufology, with the exception of one or two people. I know just about everybody now. That's how I got to meet you and Richard, because of the ICAR, the radio network, and actually... Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be honest with y'all, I harassed poor Richard and Karen at the first X Conference, or was it the second X Conference? I don't remember. It was one of the two.
One of those early ones.
It was one of the early ones. I was running around like a crazy person with his head cut off, along with several members that I had with me, and we were harassing all the poor ufologists. Oh, hold still. We need to do an interview with you. And, you know, it's funny, Karen, I was going through a couple weeks ago. I have the original tapes I did, we did the State of Ufology Today segment while we were there, and we interviewed 12 ufologists. I still have never made these public yet. I've been waiting, and they're pretty good. Richard's one of them. They're really, really good. And I've been keeping them to see how many ufologists have stayed to what they said they were going to stay to, and how many of them went off on some kind of tangent somewhere.
Uh-oh.
About 50-50, to be honest. And that's one of the reasons I've been kind of holding off on putting them public, because I don't want to get in their trouble. You know, I'm already the black sheep. So. But it was good.
Well, we'll have to remember now that you're keeping us honest.
Richard's,
I don't have to be honest.
Oh, I know that, but you could hear Richard in this interview, and you could ask Richard the same question today, and he'd answer them almost the same way.
Yeah. Well, he's embracing more topics these days than he used to.
Yeah.
Like the whole abduction question, for example. When he first started writing his first book, I know he didn't want to touch that.
Well, I don't blame you.
And, well, I think a lot of people have that feeling. You know, it's one thing to start looking honestly at lights in the sky and think maybe they're intelligently controlled, but it's a leap from there to say aliens are coming down and abducting humans.
I believe
it's happening, but that's a big jump for anyone to make. It takes time to go from point A to point B.
And when you're doing specific research, and I tell this to people all the time, I said, don't get your panties all in a wad, because, you know, if you're not an abduction researcher, you're not going to be pervy to a lot of the stuff that would convince you. And I tell that to people all the time. I said, don't make yourself crazy. I said, if it's something you're interested in, there's lots of good researchers out there that you can talk to that have very convincing information. But it's hard because, you know, Richard and I have talked about this before, about specializing in ufology. Ufology kind of needs a specialization. It used to be in the old days, we're talking 30 years ago, but in the old days you'd find a ufologist and he would be into 60 different things. Everything from Egyptology to ancient history to UFOs to New Age, which is fine, but you can't really, you're not giving your whole to any one subject when you do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I do ufology, but I do mainly abduction research in ufology, abduction research in ancient history, because they all kind of play into the same thing for me. And, of course, thanks to Melinda Leslie, I now do military abduction research.
Yeah.
Yeah, she got me... We had noticed that about 10 years ago that the military was, actually it was longer than that, but we had noticed that they were starting to abduct people and were quite heavily involved in this. But I hadn't really understood the extent, and I was doing an interview with Melinda Leslie about 7 years ago, and she brought up this rehab thing, which, by the way, Banal of America gave her that idea.
What is this, rehab?
Yeah, meaning
the repeated abductions?
Yeah, meaning reabductions is what it is.
Okay, I hadn't heard that term before.
I haven't been following
everybody's new research lately.
Yes, well, she had introduced this term to me, like I said, about 7 years ago, and it just kind of threw me.
It wasn't new research on that part.
Well, no, it's not that. I mean, if you're
nice
not
snag
in the
there.
Lab, yeah, but if you're not in the mill labs, you're not going to know about this. And you're doing a whole different side of ufology than the other ones are. You're working in something that actually was being left alone a lot itself too, so that's why me and you are kind of like the black sheep and Melinda and a few others, because we don't follow the main guys of mainstream ufology, which if there is such a thing,
I hate to say mainstream.
You know, but apparently there is, because you know experiencers are taboo and not as bad as they used to be. You know, and I got to give ufology credit that over the years. They have started to open their eyes and started accepting the fact that there are contactees and there are stuff going on that we don't understand. And if you're really going to look for information, you're going to have to go to the contactees, because, let's be honest, after 60 years of chasing UFOs, no one has come up with the smoking gun. And, you know, it's like with this thing with MUFON and Robert Bigelow. You know, now, if Robert actually gives MUFON several $1 million to pull this off, it's still not going to do anything. It's not going to change anything in the field of ufology. It's not going to make any difference whatsoever, because there's been people out there recovering evidence on the scene and sending it to high-dollar labs, and it hasn't proved anything, and it's not going to, because E.T. isn't that stupid. You know, and I don't care how much money, billionaire or not, you can't buy E.T. And so when it comes right down to it, either he's wasting his money, or there's something else going on here that we're not all pervy to yet. But if you're not doing abduction research or experiencer research, you're not going to ever get to the bottom of why E.T.'s visiting this planet. chasing UFOs will never give you a clue of what they're doing here. And now, in Robert's defense, in Mr. Bigelow's defense, he is actually looking for technology. He's not looking to find E.T. Unless I misunderstood his quote, he's not looking to find E.T. He's looking to find technologies that may advance space travel and space flight. So he might get lucky there, but like I said, in 60 years, no one's been able to crack this. And there's been several good physicists worked in the ufology field, several good scientists that have worked in the ufology field, and they haven't been able to crack this. And some of them had pretty good funding, some of them not so good. People forget that there was three majorly funded programs by the U.S. government for research on UFOs. And they couldn't crack it. So I'm kind of out
of... Now, which programs are you talking about? Like Project Blue Book?
There was Blue Book, Signs, and the first one.
Grudge?
Is it Grudge?
No, that was a later one, wasn't it?
Wait, no. Might have been Signs, Grudge, and Blue Book. There was three there.
Yeah.
One followed the other that followed the other.
Yeah, there were sort of three phases of the same project. Now, see, a lot of people believe that the reason they didn't come up with anything is just because they weren't really... Either they weren't really trying, or they were actually trying to debunk the whole issue, or they were told not to come up with any real conclusions.
Well, on Project Signs, the conclusion was that the planet was being visited. That's why the next project came. So in that particular project, there wasn't a problem with it. They just said outright, the planet's being visited. So there was the next study was an in-depth study, and then it kind of seemed to wash it away. It was like the Condon Report. If you've ever read the report itself, there's actually key information in there. Even though they're debunking ufology, there's information in there that makes it almost impossible to debunk what they were debunking, which was just weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was kind of wondering what kind of crack rocks they were on when they did this. But no, you know, anytime you're dealing with particular types of scientists or particular types of government members, I've just learned to kind of, you know, go with the flow and hope for the best. Because there's a lot of stuff out there. But chasing UFOs is fun. I mean, I still do it. I go out. We do sky watches from time to time. We go out to Biloxi, Mississippi, or Pensacola, Florida, or sometimes down to Jacksonville, or out to the oldest city in the U.S., or sometimes right here in Louisiana we'll do it. And we still organize sky watches, good sky watches. Sometimes 50, 60 people show up. And it's a lot of fun, and even sometimes we even get some good video footage and some good tapes. But it doesn't prove anything. You know, we're photographing these UFOs on a regular basis, but it doesn't prove it's E.T. It just proves it's something unidentified. You know, the only way you're going to ever prove E.T. is if someone physically sees the craft on the ground and the E.T. coming out of the craft, or if they're an abductee and they've had experiences with extraterrestrials. Because it doesn't...
Well, right. I mean, a lot of people claim to have had exactly those experiences. And you've got people like Ted Phillips who spent, 30 years collecting physical trace evidence from these landings.
Yeah. And Ted's done a pretty good job. I've talked with Ted about three times, and I actually enjoy talking to him. And that's the thing. So we have trace case evidence already. And this brings us back to what we were talking about with MUFON and Robert. I mean, we have trace case evidence. I'm not exactly sure what they're going to be looking for. Trying to prove E.T.'s here, everybody already knows the planet's being visited. There's no major organizations out there, including MUFON, that's not going to say the planet's not being visited. Any major ufology organization, and even a lot of other mainstream organizations now, are starting to think, well, yeah, you know, there's evidence to suggest something's going on other than the U.S. government or some military-type operation.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we have just literally 6,000 years of visitation. When you actually do your homework, you know, just, you know, a lot of people like to say ufology started 60 years ago with the Foo Fighters in World War II, and then followed up into Roswell and into what we call modern ufology today.
That's better than most people say, because I think most people say it goes back to Roswell.
Yeah, a lot of people do cut it off at Roswell because they don't remember the Foo Fighters or the mass sightings over Washington, D.C., but that goes back to not doing your homework. So, you know, a lot of people stopped 60 years ago, but... If you go back, I mean, there's literally, through the Middle Ages, there's literally, I think, more than 1,000 pictures and reports of things floating around or flying around in the skies. Well, let's be honest. 1,000 years ago, the only thing that should have been flying in the sky was a bird. Other than that, there shouldn't be anything flying in the sky. But that's those reports. And then you have another batch of reports that date back to the Sumerians, the ancient Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Dogon. These are 6,000-year-old reports. And then you have the cave drawings in America where the three discs are hovering over the herd of buffalo. That's 5,000 to 7,000 years old. There's another one they found in the cave in Europe that dates back 55,000 years. So So it's you know, this isn't by any means anything new that started any time recent. This is something that's been going on for a long time. And that's what actually worries me the most, Karen, because it has been going on for so long. You know, people ask me what are they here for, or what are they, what are, you got to judge everything by their actions, just like you do with people. Well, they've been here for at least 6,000 years. They haven't wiped us out. So apparently they're not here to conquer the planet, at least not in the way we think of it. They haven't really enlightened the species anywhere along the line, because let's be honest, most humans are quite...
That's what I keep saying. You know, if there are space brothers and they're here to help us, they're not doing a very good job of it. We're in pretty bad shape right now.
Yeah,
or
we are.
Was it in the 60s they used to say they were here to clean up the environment or to tell us to clean it up? And I thought, wow, they're really pretty effective, huh? Because we're in a much bigger mess now than we were then.
Yeah, we are. And the thing about it is it doesn't seem to be changing, and it doesn't seem to be adding light. And you do have what I like to call the peace, love, and light contactees, but there's no real basis to what they're saying. I mean, there's been no place that we can see where ET has directly interfered with our evolution and helped us out. Because let's be honest, 6,000 years ago, they could have introduced some basic technologies to the planet, and today we would be 10 or 15,000 years more advanced than we are now across the board. But they didn't do that. Now, if you want to say that they were messing around with our religion, then you can say that they interfered in the fact that they gave us morals, or that's kind of a stretch, but still. Because a lot of people seem to think some of the more modern religions are ET-orientated, because they were designed for the man, by man, for the control of man. So a lot of people seem to think they're ET-orientated. Whether they are or not, I don't even think makes a difference, because I can't see, you know, religion has kept us down for 5 or 6,000 years. I mean, every major scientist today agrees that through the Middle Ages, if we wouldn't have had religion, our planet would be at least 4,000 years more advanced than it is today. At least 4,000 years more advanced. There was actually a think tank out of New York did a study on this, and they came up with 8,000 years. They said that's how much the Inquisitions in the Middle Ages set us back technologically, because of people like Leonardo and Galileo and others that would have normally came out and really pushed their work forward were scared to be, you know, well, burnt on a cross or brought down or you know, brought to the Inquisition as a heretic. So they just sat on it. And, you know, it's like Notre Dame. He really feared for his life several times as he was growing old. So, you know, it wasn't a good time for science, even though there was some very major science done. It just never got put in the mainstream. And it took us another 1,000 years after that before we, like the hang glider that Leonardo invented. It was 1,800 years later, or 1,400 years later, when we flew. No, I'm sorry, it was 600 years later. Sorry about that. I was on a whole different thing. But it was 400 or 500 years later when we flew it for the first time. If we would have flown it 600 years ago, flight would have been so much more advanced now, it wouldn't even have been funny. The Wright brothers would have never been the first ones to fly. The Europeans would have been the first ones to fly. America probably would have never even been a nation, because there would have been flight, and we would have developed in a whole different way. So you got to kind of wonder about what all would have came out of this and what wouldn't have. So there was definitely looks like there was something that interfered to slow us down technologically, but I'm not going to be the one that said it was ET. It might have just been man's way of controlling man, and we just got slowed down because of it, because unfortunately power corrupts absolutely. Power and money corrupt absolutely, and I imagine a lot of those religious people were very corrupt. Not just them, a lot of the leaders and all were very corrupt, so I don't want to put it off on ET. That's the reason we're behind. It could or could not be. But my point is, if they would have interfered as a friend of ours, we'd have been much more advanced than we are today. Much, much, much more advanced. Even if they would have interfered even 50 years ago, we'd have been much more advanced than we are today. But we're not. We're sitting here on what seems to be a steady increase of technology. No big leaps, no big fantasies. We still haven't gone back to the moon. We still haven't been to Mars, even though the Apollo program, in case y'all didn't notice, ladies and gentlemen, the Apollo program was originally designed to go to Mars. The moon was only supposed to be a stepping stone to work out the bugs so that we could go to Mars. The moon was never supposed to be the end-all of our space travel. It was just supposed to be a stepping stone. And that is a sad fact, because here we are 30-something years later, and we're not even attempting to go to Mars. We're thinking about going back to the moon.
It really does seem strange that we made so many advances in space travel. We got out there, we got to the moon, we sent all these people out, and then it's like the whole program just kind of fizzled out. I mean, some people say that's because we got out there and saw something and either were, you know, scared off or were told not to go out there or saw something that we didn't want to share or that, you know, the NASA didn't want to share with us, what do you think about that? I mean, why would our space program just have stopped like that?
Well, if you go with the Neil Armstrong claims, or the claims that people said about Neil Armstrong and us being waved off the moon by aliens, okay, that's one possibility. The problem with that is I noticed, you know, we didn't stop going to the moon after Neil Armstrong. There was still what? He was Apollo 11, so there was Apollo 12, Apollo 13, which didn't make it. But so there was 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, I believe. So there was still another six launches to the moon before we finally stopped going to the moon. So if E.T. had warned us off, I think we would have stopped right then and there. I think we'd have said, oh, wait a minute now. What the hell? Or maybe we just went to a different part of the moon. Maybe they told us we couldn't come to that part of the moon, because we never did go back to that exact part of the moon again. So maybe that's what it was. Maybe they did. A lot of people said that popularity for space travel waned in the United States, and that's why funding was cut. It's hard to say. I mean, I was alive back then. I remember Skylab and a lot of other stuff going on at the time. And I do remember as we got into the early 70s and even into the early 80s, there was a waning of interest in space technologies and space travel. But I don't see where that was enough to keep us from going back to the moon or even attempting to go to Mars. I'm not sure what went on there. And you got to wonder about this because Von Braun, in his diary, talks about us going to Mars. He, as far as he was concerned, there was nothing to keep us from forming a colony on Mars 40 years ago. And, you know, we hear all the time, oh, we don't have the technologies. Well, that's BS. We do have the technologies to go to Mars. Might take a little while to get there, but we have the technologies to go there. We have the technologies to live there, and we have the technologies to colonize. We don't have the technologies to terraform, but we have the technologies to colonize.
But that's what makes it so interesting. If we have the technology, and we were talking about it 40 years ago, why aren't we there?
Yeah, why aren't we there?
What happened?
Now, you know, I do hear a lot of people talk about aliens on Mars. You know, this is something that came up with a lot of times. 20 years ago, we used to talk about this a lot because, you know, I had said they're going to find liquid water on Mars. It's definitely liquid water on Mars. They're going to probably find some type of biological life on Mars. Well, now we know there's water on Mars, and they're pretty sure that there's some type of life on Mars. And now we're not talking big aliens, but they do think there's some kind of biological life, you know, maybe some kind of microbiological life on Mars. So they're pretty sure they're going to find that. You know, that's a given. Now where the argument is so much is that we're going to find intelligent life. Or we're going to find the remnants of intelligent life. Mm-hmm. Was there intelligent life on that planet at one time? Maybe it migrated here 50 million years ago. See, there's a lot of arguments for this as far as, you know, like a matter of fact, I was talking about this last night with a group. How come the human clock, you know, Earth has 23 and three-quarter hour days, in case y'all didn't know that. Most everybody should know that. But if, in case you didn't, we have 23 and three-quarter hour days. Mars has 24 and a quarter hour days. What is the human biological clock set to? Does any of y'all know? This is interesting.
I don't know.
24 and a quarter hours.
Oh.
So why is it that a human, and get this is another thing that's interesting, the optimal body temperature for humans to work in is 66 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? On Earth, the average overall temperature on the planet at any given moment is 86 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 20 degrees higher than optimal working temperature for the human body. Well, guess what they think Mars' optimal temperature was 53 million years ago? 66 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Now, they can't prove it, and it was a long time ago, but they're pretty sure if the planet evolved like they think it did, and it did have an atmosphere, and it did have liquid water on it like they think it had, it's a good chance that that was what it was. And if that's the case, you got to wonder what's going on here. You know, and a friend of mine made a good point to me a few weeks ago about this. He said, Joe, he said, if we truly evolved on this planet, why didn't we evolve gills and have webbed feet and webbed hands? He said, the planet's 80% water, 76% water. He said, you would have thought the most dominant, most intelligent species would have evolved to use both the land and the water. But we're not a water species by any means. We can't even take very much pressure. We're actually quite a delicate species compared to everything else on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, guys. It freaks me out. I mean, there's no, you know, I hear a lot of mainstream scientists talking about this today because we don't fit with evolution on Earth. And we are related to everything on Earth, though. which means we probably brought a lot of stuff with us, but there's no way of real knowing until we get to Mars. And that might be why it's taken so long to get to Mars, because NASA may already know. They may have already known that there was life on Mars at one time, that maybe even we developed on Mars at one time. And you can't change history that quickly. That's one of the problems here. You can't come in and go, well, guess what, guys? Y'all are all wrong. Your gods are all wrong. Your Gaia theory is wrong because you're not from this planet, so you can't even worship Gaia on this planet because you're from Mars or somewhere else. And I do understand this. I truly do. It's a pickle, and I'm not sure how we're going to ever get out of this. It's like, I mean, I know you're familiar with panspermia and some of the other thoughts on how we got here. Bottom line is, if you're listening to us tonight, any way you look at this, you are not native to planet Earth. If you believe in panspermia, then the building blocks of life were brought here by comets and asteroids and deposited on this planet. So you're not native, okay? If you believe God put you here, you are not native. If you believe aliens put you here, you are not native. And if you believe we came from another world and migrated here, you are not native to this planet. In other words, life on Earth came from somewhere else any way you look at it. Where did we come from? And I guess that's the question. See, for me, it's important because if it's panspermia, that means that the universe is full of life. It's an abundance of life out there. If it's something else, then it might change what may or may not be in space. But if panspermia is the way we got to planet Earth, then that tells you right there. The building blocks of life have been deposited across the entire known galaxy, or the entire known universe for that matter. And anywhere that life can start, we learned on Earth, it will start. And we know that hostile environments are not a means to keep life from starting. So if that's true, you're going to find life all over the place. Now, if we evolve some other way, you might not find as much life out there. You may only find it in limited areas and limited pockets and certain, you know, planet-type systems. But that's what we really need to find out, how exactly man came to be on this planet, because it will make a difference as far as, you know, how many may or may not be in the known galaxy. Because last I heard, there was 200 billion stars in the known galaxy. That puts it roughly at 2 to 3 trillion planets. And out of that 2 to 3 trillion planets, they believe at least 100 billion of them are Earth-type planets. Guys, you know how much life that is? Like us, that's not just life like anything else. We're talking life like ourselves. That's a lot of planets, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, NASA just said 2 months ago they expect to find life on 4 to 5 other planetary systems. I mean, planetoids in our solar system. So that means...
And that's a tiny area when you're looking at... I mean, the whole universe.
Yeah, it is. But they're talking just in our solar system. They're planning. They expect to find life in 4 or 5 other planets. Not talking about intelligent life, mind you. But they're talking about life.
But life.
You know, they think they're going to find it on Mars. They think they're going to find it on Io. They think they're going to find it in Europa. And they think they're going to find it in a couple other places. They think they're going to find it on Venus, in the upper atmospheres. And you know, that's the thing. If this is true, this means life is very resilient, and it's going to start all over the place. Now, let's be honest. Earth is a very, very, very young planet.
Mm-hmm.
We're very young in the grand scheme of our galaxy. We're less than 4 billion years old. The galaxy itself is 13 billion years old, so we're babes. And there could have been life out there started billions of years before us. Now, here's one for all of y'all. This ought to throw all of y'all into a tantrum. There was a scientist a few years ago introduced a new theory on how Earth became to be here. 1 billion years ago, there was a galaxy that brushed by the side of our galaxy. And they know it deposited materials and planets and solar systems and the galaxy. They think our solar system was deposited here from another galaxy. Now even mainstream science is beginning to think that this solar system is not native to this galaxy. So that means if we are life and we were, that means that's a whole other ball game there, because we're from a whole other galaxy. We don't even know what the hell is in this galaxy.
Wow.
And then y'all know in another billion years we're going to slam into the Andromeda galaxy.
And then we'll hit you right on that.
You know, of course, what's a billion years for none of us? None of us will be here. But still, you know, the more you get into this stuff, the deeper and thicker and nastier it gets.
Yeah.
But I like it. It keeps my brain functioning.
Exactly. We should be thinking about things like that, if for no other reason than to exercise our brains. You know, it's so much better than coming home from work and watching Britney Spears on TV checking to see what she's up to. You know, when you were talking about the different forms of life elsewhere in the universe, it just made me think, too, that most people talk about life in other galaxies or life on other planets. And they, you know, I've had this discussion with so many people. They say, well, there's this tiny, tiny, narrow little range of conditions that allow life to exist. And I always say, yeah, but that's life like us. I mean, you could say even on this planet that life couldn't exist underwater because we can't breathe in water. But you know what? There are fish.
Yeah.
And there are so many things. Even once you accept the fact that there are fish, there are certain kinds of marine worms that live near volcanic water spouts where the water is filled with things like sulfuric acid, where even there, scientists thought for years nothing could live in that part of the ocean because it's just so acidic. And darn if they didn't find marine worms that eat the sulfur.
Yeah, recently, they've expanded the parameter of life. Most evolutionary scientists think today that there's a much wider parameter for life than we originally realized, because they have found life living in subarctic temperatures, you know, 40, 50, 60 below. They found life living in boiling waters or with sulfuric acid. So they're learning that, you know, we can't base our opinion on life based on human thoughts, ideas, and designs. We just can't. And bottom line is, we're babies. We're not even got out the womb yet, guys. Come on, we're in our little pretty little spaceship womb-y thingy. You know, we're barely poking out. Every once in a while, somebody pokes their head out and goes in space, but then we come right back. We're not even ready to get out the womb yet. We haven't even gone to a new world yet. I mean, we're just basically hanging around and you know, doing nothing, really. Tearing up our planet and cussing each other is what I see us do most of the time.
Pretty much.
You know, and we act like a bunch of kids in a playpen. That's what we're acting like. You got your bullies, your submissives, and everybody in between. And it's a shame. So if you're an alien visiting this planet, you're thinking, oh, my God, these people are morons. But we're young, you know. And I would bet you money that any intelligent life, unless they were here to conquer the planet or rule the planet, would look at us that way and say, well, you know what? They are intelligent, barely, but they are intelligent, but they are very young. You know, in the grand scheme of the universe and evolution, if you go by evolution, man is less than 2 million years old. Come on, compared to everything else on the planet, we are just neon, pimple-head little suckers. I mean, we're just nothing. I mean, dolphins are 300 million years older than we are. You know, we're just babies, and that's all we are. And I guess if you're an alien looking at it, you expect us to mess up and to do things. I just don't understand why they just aren't more forthcoming or more open with what they do.
Well, you know, there's a really good comment on the message board right now that sort of ties in with what we've been discussing. Someone here has mentioned that there's really no reason for any alien species to interact with us if we're not aware of any life forms other than what we have here on this planet, and if we haven't really been able to reach outside our own planet yet. You know, once we start traveling using the same space that they're using to get here, then it would make more sense that they would contact us.
Well, you see, that's the thing, and that's an interesting point, because until just recently, until World War II, or actually until the 1930s, we weren't broadcasting anything. You know, no one, we weren't sending any signals out. Now, since 1920-something, whenever the Olympics was, when the Hitler broadcast was, that's the most powerful broadcast at the time, the first one to be able to leave the solar system. And it's out somewhere, quite a few light years out now. I think it's 60 or 70 light years out. And so it's way out there. So anything in that 70 light years in a circle pattern from Earth now is aware of Earth, okay? Unfortunately, their first message they ever got was from Hitler. That kind of bothers me, but still, you know, that was the first. And then I'm thinking, you know, you're sitting on a distant world, and about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I Love Lucy comes on. You know, what do you think? You know, you're an alien, you see I Love Lucy, or Star Trek, or any of that stuff. I mean, how do you take this stuff? Do you take this as who we are, or do they understand that it's entertainment or television? Or when
do they understand the concept of making up stories for fun? Do they have a sense of humor?
And that's a scary thing, because they might think everything they're seeing from TV is real.
Uh-huh. And they might be completely misinterpreting. I mean, aside from thinking it's all real, they could be interpreting it in a totally different way that we couldn't even understand.
Yeah, it's true. So, you know, that's we don't even know what they're thinking as we're broadcasting it. But that was enough to get some attention to the planet. And that's why a lot of ufologists and a lot of people think that this started 50 or 60 years ago, because we started broadcasting signals and someone became aware of us. Now, there's some other things that, being that Earth is out way out on the edge of the spiral arm, We may have been interested, especially if we were deposited here by another galaxy, we may be of interest to aliens that live in this galaxy. This might be a scientific study because this might be the only way they can study something from another galaxy is by coming here. You know, because if we're not native to their galaxy, they're like, wow, these guys are really aliens. They're alien from another galaxy aliens, so let's go check them out. So we don't know. I mean, that's the problem. We don't know. Now, like I said earlier when I was talking with Karen, you have to judge them by their actions. Now, in most cases, they don't seem to be here to kill us or to help us, but they are taking people against their will. And even people that tell me they have excellent or great contact experiences are still being taken against their will. They're not calling them up and saying, hey, John, I'm going to come pick you up tonight. I got to poke you and prod you, maybe pull an eyeball out or something, but I'm going to erase your memory and put you back so you're not going to have to worry about it. No, they don't do that. Okay, they don't. They just come get you. Now, a lot of contactees know when they're coming, especially the more advanced contactees know when they're coming. But still, they're not asking. And for the people that tell me I signed the contract when you were a baby, no, I don't think so.
Well, this is where you can get into all kinds of funky things like the interlife and, you know, planning what experiences you're going to go through in the coming life. Although I've never heard that brought up in connection with alien abduction.
Well, there is a group that believes that that the greys, especially, have the ability to recognize your soul as it comes and goes. Meaning that 2,000 years ago, they may have abducted you and knew it was you. And 2,000 years later, when they're abducting you now, they knew it was you from 2,000 years ago. I that is something I have never had enough evidence to prove either way, and I really, really, really don't know. I do know that a single gray may be the same gray that abducted your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents 3,000 years ago might be the same gray that's abducted you. We do know that. And we do know that they stay in those family lines. So we know those things, but I couldn't tell you if they actually knew. Because the grays don't seem, and I don't want to rule it out, but they don't really seem to have a real spiritual side to them. The reptilians do, but the grays don't. The grays seem to be, the best way I could describe the grays is like Vulcans. That's what they're like. It's not that they don't have any emotions, because they do have emotions, and they do have anger and joy, but not like humans do, and they don't show them like humans do. But from those studies where we've been programming contactees to get information from the grays, we've learned that sometimes the grays, when a contactee gets programmed, when the gray first picks them up and they're on board the ship or in the facility, and the contactee wakes up, the first thing the contactee does is broadcast all those questions out of its head. A lot of times the grays will respond without thinking about it, because it's like when they're talking with other grays, they respond without thinking about it. Well, on several occasions, we've seen where grays have been like the proud top of, oh, wow, look, my contactee did this. But then in the same breath, we've seen them like, what the hell did you just do? And they've been punished severely for it. So, you know, they do have emotions, just not to the extent that we have emotions. So that's a strange little phenomenon in itself. It scares the daylights out of me sometimes.
A lot of people have said that the aliens, especially the grays, seem to be very interested in learning about human emotion. Is that your experience with your work in ICAR and working with other abductees? Do you think that may be true?
In the beginning, I have to be honest, in the beginning I thought maybe that's what it was. I even thought maybe the grays were from the future in the beginning. But, you know, now that I know the grays actually have emotions, I don't think they're actually studying our emotions. I actually think they get a kick out of our emotions sometimes. But you have to remember, for me, I think they've been here 6,000 plus years. You could have learned about emotion in the first 100 years, or even the first 500 years. It's not going to take any species that advanced 6,000 years to figure out humans are not, you know, the most stable species on the planet. So maybe in the beginning it was, but I think today, whatever it is, it's much different. And it's like the breeding programs. We know they're running these breeding programs, but not like we thought they were in the beginning. At first, everybody thought they were breeding hybrids for like the grays to use, or humans to use, or reptilians to use. That doesn't seem to be what they were doing. Today it looks like more like they're breeding hybrids for our own personal use, for the transfer of consciousness from one body to the other. By the way, the U.S. government is working on this, being able to take your consciousness from your mind and download it into a clone. We're working on this right now.
The aliens are doing this for humans to use, not for themselves?
No, because they probably already have mastered it for themselves. But it seems like that these bodies, these hybrid bodies, were actually a way of designing humans a better body. Because for space travel or even exploration, humans are a very frail species. We're not very strong. Our brain capacity isn't all that great. In general, we're kind of a fragile species. And what happened was, we started getting these reports, and I'm sure you've heard these yourself, but we'll get reports where a contactee will say they'll go into a room or they'll be in a spaceship, and there'll be lines and lines of people, like in tubes or in stasis or something, just lines and lines. Well, what happened was is we started asking people to look. Tell us what they look like. A lot of people would start describing them, and then all of a sudden they would realize it was them or their kids or their family members or so on or so forth. So the body was a little different than the one they have now, but it was them in stasis, which suggests somewhere along the line the aliens are planning on taking that consciousness from that person and uploading it into that new body. Now here's another little interesting thing. For years and years and years, we couldn't figure out why do gray spaceships show up at graveyards. You know, we always, because there's massive...
No, I had never heard that.
Yeah, well, there's a massive amount of sightings of gray ships showing up over mortuaries or graveyards.
Oh, my gosh.
So we started checking into it, and the only thing we can find out is they're actually taking that consciousness at that moment. They're just taking it, you know. Yeah, they're coming to wherever you are and removing their consciousness from that body.
Well, they're coming after death.
After death, yeah. They're coming after death.
Wow.
So what we did was is we took a bunch of contactees. It was more than 100 of them we did this with. And we programmed them to ask the graves if this is what they were doing. Every one of them contactees came back and said yes. Every one.
Mm.
And what was funny about this is, or scary about this is, only about 25 of these contactees were U.S. citizens. The other 75 were living in different countries and different cities all around the planet. So this was a very diverse group of people that had no contact with each other whatsoever. And they all came back. We've been doing these kind of studies for about 12 or 14 years now.
You know what I think is almost the creepiest part of that whole thing? It's not even consciousness being removed or the grays and spaceships being in graveyards, but that implies that after someone dies, their consciousness is there in that coffin, in that graveyard, until someone comes to get them.
You know, that kind of freaked me out, too.
That's really crazy.
That kind of freaked me out, too. Because I asked a friend of mine about souls and stuff like that. I said, well, wait. I said, this means that your soul is in that damn coffin when they bury you. I said, because I told them I want to be cremated. And I said, what are they going to do then? How are they going to get my consciousness when they cremate me? You know? And the way it was explained to me, and I don't know whether or not this is true or not, I don't know, but the way a lot of the contactees have explained it is the graves know approximately when you're going to die. They have a good idea of when you're going to die. If for some reason they can't be there at the moment, which, because, you know, a lot of ships are reported over hospitals, so a lot of times they do take you at the moment of death. They say the graves have a way of isolating your consciousness until the time that they can come pick it up. There's a way that they can, like, loop it in your mind or something, which scares the hell out of me, because are you conscious when they bury you? I mean, is your mind still recording this when this is going on? And the contactees say no, and I'm hoping they're right on this.
Yeah, I mean, everything I've read about the near-death experience describes people, you know, hovering over their body in the hospital while the staff is still working on it.
Yeah.
You know, and they come back, you know, because the ones we've heard from are the ones that have come back into their body and survived.
You know, one of the things that freaks me out about those kind of experiences is we had done some regressions with some friends of ours and a near-death experience stuff. And this was 12, 14 years ago. And we were actually regressing them to the moment of birth. And then we would take it like a near-death experience and compare it to the birth experience. They were almost identical. They were talking about long tubes with bright lit areas and family members and people standing around them and talking and bringing them, oh, hi, we love you, and grabbing them and hugging them. They were describing death and birth the same way.
And it's that interesting. I never thought of that. But
it freaked me out. I'm thinking, is this what's going on? We're dying and just being reincarnated immediately? I mean, being reborn immediately? Because it was just weird. I mean, this one's talking about, you know, oh, because they talk about the tube. course, we know when you're coming through the tunnel, I mean, through the channel and being born, yeah, it's basically a tube. You're squeezing your little head out of there. And as soon as you come out, I imagine it's really, really bright light since you haven't even been in any light in 9 months.
Yeah.
It was just weird. It was one of those weird things that, whether it means anything or not, I have no idea. But it freaks me out when I think about it. It really does. I'm like, because in one way it made a little sense that you died and were born. You know, the energy went from you at death to a baby being born at the moment of birth. And which, if that's true, that puts a whole new spin on abortions, because if the consciousness isn't in the baby until the moment of birth, then it takes a lot of pressure off the people having abortions. Oh, no, guys, I'm not, by the way, I don't have no opinion on that.
We're not going there.
I'm just shutting up right now. Don't even ask. I'm not saying nothing, because y'all are not going to harass me about this for 2 decades.
Yeah. I think that's a huge decision for anybody to make, you know, despite at what point you believe life begins.
Well, I hate to be a sissy about this, but I'm always going to be it's the woman's right to choose, because I'm not a woman and I wouldn't know. So I'm not going to ever think either way, because I don't know. I'm a man. I've never been pregnant. And if I do get pregnant, y'all will be the first one to know. But, you know, it's
bigger things to think about than that.
Yeah, so I just leave it alone, you know. I've got all my little kids running around and my grandkids and stuff. But I'll never, you know, I'll never put that on someone and say, no, you shouldn't have, or you should have, or what have you. I just don't feel like it's my place. So it's one of those things. But it is weird. I mean, so you're born, you die, you're born, you die. I mean, that could go just like that. And if the grays are actually snatching consciousness at the moment of death, or it just, the thing about them showing up at a mortuary 3 days later just freaks me out.
Well, I've read in some Eastern philosophies they believe that the soul doesn't actually dissipate or leave the body until at least 24 hours after death. You know, and some people say it takes even longer.
Well, that's the reason they do the 3-day waiting period before you bury your loved ones. You have, you know, it goes to the mortuary, and then you go to the wake, and then you have the funeral on the third day. And that's to make sure you're dead. That's why they do that. Because apparently in the old days, sometimes they thought people were dead, and then they would, like, wake up.
Yeah.
You know, and that in itself had to be a freaky experience. So,
yeah. Well, that's why they used to put those bells on graves, so people could, if they woke up buried, they could ring the bell.
Yeah, because it did happen. Apparently, it happened more than one time too. So, and there's some things that would mimic death if it had happened to you, especially some types of shock and stuff. So, it's a scary thing, but knowing that means that the graves may have a window there. You know, they may have a 3-day window to come in and collect the soul. Or I don't know if it's your soul, and see, that's another thing. When you die, is your soul leaving, but yet they're taking your consciousness? Or are they taking, like, your memories and who you are and downloading that in the body, but your soul's already gone? See, that gets real sticky and really confusing there.
And it makes you wonder why. I mean, what is there? Again, in Eastern philosophy, they talk about the soul, and, you know, there's the spiritual body, and there's the mental body, which is all your thoughts and memories. And there's the astral body, or the etheric body, which is just energy, and then the physical one. And these all kind of dissipate at different rates after the physical body dies.
Yeah, and they
do.
So
if that's all true, then it raises the question of what exactly are these beings interested in?
What are they taking?
Are they taking it? What are they doing with it?
Well, if the contactees say they're taking you, the person you are right now, they're simply taking that essence and removing it and putting it into another body. Okay,
and
I can see that at the moment of death, and I can see that before the moment of death. Because some contactees say they actually take you before you die. Okay, a lot of them say they take your essence before you die, and then when you die, this essence just goes away. It's like they clone it or copy it or something. I don't know, but it freaks me out.
Taking souls from this planet to a different one? Are they going to a different dimension? Is it a bad thing that they're taking souls out of the system here?
Yeah, is it going to diminish our... And see, if we believe in reincarnation and they're removing souls from our planet, then somewhere along the line it's going to have to diminish the whole, right? I mean, especially if you're taking more brilliant people or the higher IQ people, if they're not being reborn here, then, it's got to diminish the soul. Now, I got a friend of mine who swears we're all crazy when we talk about reincarnation, because he's like Joe. He said there's 6 billion people on the planet. Not everybody could have been reincarnated. Some of them have to be new souls. And I'm like, well, maybe you're right, because, you know, 2 million years ago, there was probably only 30 or 40,000, you know, beings on the planet. So, but I said, that doesn't mean anything. That just means that there's new souls and old souls. I said, which is what we all think anyway.
Well, right, and it doesn't mean not everyone has to be incarnated at the same time.
That's true.
There can be times when fewer souls are in physical bodies and times when more are. I mean, it's like being in a train station. You know, if you're there at certain times, it's very busy, and at other times, it's not.
Well,
it doesn't mean there are fewer people in the world. It just means they're not all right here, right now.
Now, as we grow, and like he was saying, you know, he said, you know, 200 years from now, there'll be 12 to 15 or maybe even 20 billion people on the planet. He said, well, does that mean that the people from now, the 6 billion here now, will be much, much older souls than everybody alive with you at the time?
Mm-hmm.
Which, in some aspects, I would say yes. I mean, if you're going to say reincarnation, I would say yes. Now, if it's the other way and you're simply being reincarnated at the moment of death, then I don't think it really matters, because you're probably not retaining much. But that reincarnation from death to birth does make sense for things like savants. You know, if you had died and then were born within, you know, say a few hours, you might retain some of what you had in this life. It might be carried over with you. But for the ones that cross over and then come back, no, I don't think you're going to keep that. I think it'll be left behind. You won't keep any essence. So the ones being born right away may actually keep some of what they were or who they were. Because you ever notice people have weird phobias sometimes? Like, I got friends that are deathly scared of water. No reason for them to be, by the way. They can all swim, too. But
They're
deathly scared of water. I got friends that are just have a fear of fire. They have a fear of flying or anything. And you got to kind of wonder why. Well, what's up, guys? I mean, you didn't drown. I mean, you haven't, you know, what's the deal? And then occasionally one of them tell me, you know, I had this dream where I drowned to death when I was a kid, or it was like 200 years ago, because I could tell because it was horses and buggies and so on and so forth. And it might be. I'll never be the one that says no or yay on that, because there's no way of knowing until we cross back over, and then I guess we'll get to find out.
See, this is a reason that I'm interested in the UFO phenomenon, but I'm also interested in anything that's termed even vaguely paranormal.
Well, you have to kind
because,
of be.
Well, here's a perfect example of where reincarnation and past life situations and research might dovetail with UFO and abduction research.
Especially
now, I had never heard all these things that you're telling us about the aliens being so interested in taking something, taking the soul or taking energy at the moment of death.
Yeah,
but it ties in with a lot of other things I've read in reading about reincarnation and reading about, you know, why ghosts come back and why certain souls are stuck here and why they're caught in the astral plane, because they're so fixated on something that happened in their physical life and they can't let go.
Well,
that it sounds like it's similar to whatever these aliens might be interested in.
And it is. I imagine it is in some shape. And we learned a long time ago, especially with contactees, you know, most contactees are going to have a fascination with the paranormal. A lot of them with fairies and stuff like that. A lot of them with werewolves. A lot of them with vampires. But you find this commonly amongst contactees. They have a fascination with these things. And a lot of contactees have a fascination with what I would call the New Age religion. Because they're looking for answers. You know, and they might find some of the answers there, or they may learn enough discipline to find some other answers somewhere else. But
it's like they start off knowing that there's something more to life than what most people think. They can look around at their friends and family and say, I see how you see the world, and I know it's bigger than that.
And see, I'm real lucky. I mean, iCar is about 15,000 members now. We've interviewed more than 10,000 contactees. We keep a working relationship with more than 1,000 at any given time. And it's easier for us to get information and come to conclusions, because there's so many of them, so much input coming in. It's like last night, we had the other room open, the UFO phenomena room open for chat. There was about 30 people in there last night. About half of them were contactees, and that's what we were talking about. We were talking about awakening experiences for contactees coming in, different types of why or what we're doing here. Could we possibly be from somewhere else? And these are all either members of the organization or people seeking members or contactees looking for help. And, you know, so just last night alone, I was talking to more than 15 of them for almost 5 hours. And, you know, so it's easy to accumulate a lot more information that way. And as long as they meet abduction criteria, you know, we'll take them serious. Now, if they don't meet abduction criteria, we're not going to take them serious. Now, we're going to be like, no, that's okay, thanks for offering. But, which, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, don't take that the wrong way. It doesn't mean that you're not a contactee if you don't fit ICAR's abduction criteria. It's just we work with reptilians, greys, and humans. That's the three major and the little brown guys that like to eat people and the light beings. But those five aliens are the five aliens that we do base our research on. So I'm not going to rule out that somebody might have a different experience for somewhere else. And so y'all know this because I know we're getting ready to go to break. But bottom line is we have abduction criteria for what we call base experiences, meaning like the breeding experiments or the hybrid children or different types of procedures that go on the tables, different type of stress experiments that they run on you. These are basic things that are going to happen in any abduction, no matter who's abducting you. It's going to happen. We know things that are going to happen when you were a kid, as you go into puberty. Matter of fact, you can take this to the bank. The worst experiences you will ever have on any of the aliens I just mentioned will be from puberty to about age 28. That's when they do about 98% of all the nasty stuff. After that, the contact experiences change greatly. The problem is those experiences are the same in almost all contactees. That's about 35 to 40% of the information you get from a contactee. The other 60% is widely and vastly different from contactee to contactee to contactee. And so y'all know this, they can't all be right, okay, guys? So some of them are lying intentionally. Some of them are just being misguided by the aliens. Some of them actually have real information, and some of them, I don't even know what the hell they're thinking. But it's a lot of stuff to sift through. So we work the base case stuff mainly, and then we start looking for similarities in the more broadband stuff. To find things like the Holocaust dreams. Now we know a full third of contactees have the Holocaust dreams. You know, these are things that we work really hard on. But, Karen, I just ran us over 3 minutes. I'll let you take us to break.
I'm thinking, well, you're the producer, so you can take a break whenever you can.
But go ahead, I'll let you take us out, and then we'll come
okay.
Back.
Don't go away, everybody. Do come back. I'm talking with Joe Montaldo, who is not only my producer here at Paranormal Radio Network, but he's also the head of ICAR, which is the International Community for Alien Research, and host of UFO Undercover. We're talking about some of his past work, and we're also hopefully going to talk about his upcoming presentations at the Ozark UFO Conference and at the X Conference next month. This is Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network, and we're going to take a bit of a break. Don't go too far. Hi, everyone. We're back, and you're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest this evening is Joe Montaldo, who is not only my producer here on Through the Keyhole, he's also the head of Paranormal Radio Network and host of his own show, UFO Undercover. He is also, in addition to that, the founder, national director, and spokesperson for the International Community for Alien Research. I hope you were able to hear the first part of the show, and if you are just joining us now, you're going to want to check out the archives on this one because Joe is an absolute fountain of information. We have been talking about all kinds of really outrageous information that he's come up with over his many, many years of working with many abductees. I think you said something like 10,000 that your organization has worked with, Joe?
It's over 10,000 now, yeah.
Yeah,
Actually, out of the 15,000 members ICAR has at the moment, probably about 7,000 or 8,000 of them are contactees. That's why we call it the Experiencer Organization. It's because that's basically what it is. But I got to say, the reason this organization got founded is I used to be a field investigator for MUFON. My wife was a data analyst, basically, for MUFON. And we had been for quite some time. We'd been working with them. And we had a personal experience in Gulf Breeze, Florida, which MUFON still has the original report. And it was very advanced, very evolved. You can find it at www.alienenigma.org. It's a personal experience that Linda and I had. It's posted to it's on an old website. Alien Enigma is 11 years old. It's my own personal website, but it's old. It hasn't been updated in 4 or 5 years. But I leave it up there. And the reason I did this, and I'm going to be honest with y'all, is for years and years I was on the radio and doing stuff, but nobody knew I was a contactee. No one. So when I came out, I didn't want people to say, oh, he came out because it's popular, blah, blah, this, or blah, blah, that, or blah, blah, this. This way, it had already been posted on the Internet since 1997. So there was no argument. You know, it's been there for that long, so no one could say, oh, he just made it up or he changed his mind. So, but if you get a chance, go over and read it. There's a lot of good stuff there. There's some personal artwork there. There's some pictures we took down in Gulf Breeze at the time of the experiences, and it is a personal experience. But that experience... We sent it to MUFON. Walt Anders addressed it personally, and it was a very good experience we had with Walt. And Walt mailed it back. Well, the first time we mailed it, by the way, it came back to us in an envelope that had been cut up into like 50 pieces and then taped back together. We still got it, by the way.
Oh, my God.
It was taped with Scotch tape. So I called them up and asked them, had they got it? They said no, so we remailed the letter again. And, of course, Walt got it, and he contacted us, and we talked. Now, we got involved with them. We started working with MUFON. We were doing quite a lot of research with MUFON, and we were sending in, on average, 15 or 20 reports a month. Okay, guys? And all of a sudden, MUFON got new leadership, and then everything became like the black hole of Calcutta. You couldn't get answers anymore. Information was being sent in without any responses. You couldn't find it in a database, because MUFON used to have a private database for investigators. It was just disappearing. It was so. After a while, I got a little discouraged and a little disgusted, and I started talking to some of the other directorship at MUFON and some of my friends over there and said, guys, what's going on? And they basically felt the same way, and I met some people on Yahoo in 1998, and I got to talking with them, and they co-founded the International Community for Alien Research so that there will always be an organization out there that is contactee-friendly. The organization is designed to be contactee-friendly. It's actually a mentorship organization, meaning that if you contact us and we think you're a contactee, we're going to always put you in touch with either another contactee or a veteran field investigator so that you're getting attention response. Because our goal is to help you through these experiences. For us, it's a twofold thing. We can help you through your experiences because we understand a lot of what you're going to go through. Especially if you're in a particular age group, we understand a lot of what you're going to go through, and there's a lot of people we can hook you up with that have had these same experiences. But while we're doing that, we're earning your trust, and of course, you're telling the stuff that's going on in your contactees, in your experiences, in your family lines with your children, your grandchildren, so on and so forth, and we're adding that to our data. I used to keep an online database. Ever since Katrina, I took it down, though, so everything now is either kept on hard drives. There's two hard drives to keep it in, or I keep it in my head, one or the other. And because Katrina taught me a valuable lesson in twofold. One, we lost 3,000 or 4,000 cases. A friend of ours who was the secretary of IACR at the time had them all in a filing cabinet. They were paper cases.
Mm.
And, of course, Katrina put 8 feet of water in the house, and it all became paste.
Yeah.
Along with that, we lost several thousand membership applications, which most of them people have found their way back now, but still, it was a lot to recover from. But by saying that, someone after Katrina, and I'm saying someone because I don't know who it is, came in and removed the hard drives from all three of her computers. Left the computers, and she had really expensive computers, by the way. Left the computers, only took the hard drives. And actually, you could tell where they had gone through just the three filing cabinets to see if there was anything else that could be recovered. So after that point, now they're on USB hard drives that are taken with me when I go places. They come with me. And there's a backup I keep with one friend of mine that I will never tell anybody who they are. You can drug me, beat me, whatever, you're not going to find out. And the rest is in my head or in other researchers' heads from the organization. And it works out real well. And we keep a big tab on everything that goes on. But you got to understand something, too. We were able to cheat, okay? Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and Whitley Strieber were out there doing some pretty hard-hitting work, along with John Mack. So one of the nice things for us is, you know, they did the fundamental basis of work. I went through all four of their works and found the similarities in their work, okay? Took that and used that the basis to build the IACAR organization and the IACAR database because it took out a lot of the basics for me. So I could use that as a fundamental building block and then add to it with our data. Matter of fact, a couple of years ago I was in Laughlin, Nevada, speaking with Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs. They had tables there. I was out there working press, as a matter of fact. And I walked in there. Him and Bud were sitting next to each other talking, and I walked up, I introduced myself, said, how you doing, and asked them how come they hadn't gone any further than where they had, because it's like they cut off. They didn't go to the next logical step with the research. They just stopped it at a certain point. So I asked David, and David and I got to talking. The next thing I knew, for about 2.5 to 3 hours, the three of us had a conversation that if you could have been there for, you could have educated yourself 20 years in ufology ahead of everyone else.
Mm.
We literally, I'm not kidding you, we literally had the whole end of the, it was where they had like all the books and the stuff for sale. The whole backside of that was so full of people trying to hear what we were talking about that you couldn't even move in there anymore. It was just packed. And it was it should have been a conversation that was held in a private location, but it was a damn good conversation. And, it enlightened me to some of Bud and David's other stuff that they were doing, and it just helped further the data along. So, I give them credit for doing the groundwork, even though I don't agree with David on a lot of things. I do give them credit for doing some of the basic groundwork. And then we built from that. Now, what's interesting about that, if you ask Yvonne Smith, Daryl Sims, any Katarina Wilson, Maria Delicato, Suzanne Hansen, Mary Rodwell, a few of the others that I work with closely, you will find that the basic data between us, and this is what's really weird, about 72 to 76% of our data matches. Now, granted, we have more of it than they do, but what we're doing is, and I've had several conversations with Yvonne Smith about this and some of her contactees, and with Mary Rodwell and some of her contactees, with Suzanne Hansen and a few of the others, and Jim Sparks, and Katarina Wilson, by the way, is one of my favorites. Leah Haley, I've actually had several conversations with this about. We actually sat down and looked at what was the same, and this is what's weird, because if you went back 20 years ago, abduction research wasn't this close together. In today's society, in the group of people I miss, which is the major people that are doing abduction research in ufology today, our research is about 75% matches, and that is phenomenal. You don't find that anywhere else in ufology, and it is phenomenal, and it lets you know that these contactees that are having these experiences are telling the truth, because here you have a whole host of more than 15 researchers where their data is running true to each other's data, and that's
a huge percentage.
Yeah, it is, and it floors them. Matter of fact, when Daryl and I were talking about it, because Daryl freaked out on our first interview we did when he found out I did generational cases. He's like, oh, Joe, I didn't think anybody else did that but me. And I was like, well, I said, I got a few more than you do. But we have generational cases that span anywhere from 4 to 6 generations in a family. And we have actually been tracking, in some of these families, I can honestly say more than 15 years, we have been tracking these families' abductions, 6 or 7 family members at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the great-grandmother, the grandmother, the mother, the child, the grandchild, and the great-grandchild, and sometimes even their siblings. We have all of this. And we can sit there and go through and see how they're being abducted, what's the difference from the great-great-grandchild to the great-great-grandmother, and so on and so forth. And it gives us a very unique understanding about alien abductions and what's actually going on in an alien abduction. What this organization that I work for has been doing for the last 10 years, nobody else in the field has really been doing. And it's not because they don't want to. It's because, like I said, I've had the radio show. We've got a very public base on the Internet. My show is going out to 500,000 listeners. So I have a much larger group of people to work with than the average contactee or the average researcher is going to get. There's a few researchers out there that could probably tap a large database. Karen's husband's one of them because he's a good researcher. Stanton's one of them. Daryl's one of them. There's about maybe 5. And all of the people that work in ufology today that can really hit a broadband audience and have enough respect that the audience may respond to what they're saying or what they're doing. In general, though, you're not going to find it. Most ufologists are too flip-flopping back and forth, so the mainstream is kind of like, okay, whatever. and not to pick on my fellow ufologists, but, a lot of y'all are. A lot of y'all flip-flop back and forth. I noticed, Karen, you stay true to what you're doing. I've noticed that now. I've seen you do 2 presentations, and I've heard you on 2 different radio shows, and I noticed you stay pretty true to what you're doing. So,
well, thanks. I actually would like to branch out a bit.
Well, I see the book.
I have that presentation, but I told Rich I have this terror of being branded the Teletubby Lady. I really don't want to be that.
Don't worry.
It was something that struck me, and I thought somebody should talk about it. But I really would like to.
Desensitization of our children is important. And
well, yeah, it is. I mean, I did think it should be brought up. It's not something I'm interested in spending my whole life on. There are a lot of other things. You know what? I'm interested in the airships. I think that's fascinating.
Well, you see, you're lucky, too, because Rich is a ufologist. You're a ufologist. You know.
Oh, I have this research. You know, I have this amazing resource right here, plus his whole library, plus my whole library.
Plus everybody y'all know from traveling and being in ufology. So
yeah. Yeah, there's so many people. I feel like I could just, you know, if I had a question, I could just pick up the phone and call so many people. And
it does. It makes it way easier, and then you can feel around. Like when you see, that's what I do a lot of times. I'll invite somebody on the show because I'm fishing.
Yeah,
I'm fishing for information.
Yeah, anytime something catches my interest, I Google it. I find somebody who's doing research in that area and invite them on the show.
Yeah, and it's cheating, y'all, but it works real well.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I don't go stealing other people's
research,
but if there's something I'm interested in, yeah, I get a chance to spend 2 hours talking with somebody who knows a lot about it.
And what's nice for me is being that it's the Paranormal Radio Network, because I have a big interest in paranormal, but I kind of stay out of it because of the ufology end that I do. I get to hear all this anyway. You know, it's like Portal. I mean, they know everybody who's anybody in ufology. I mean, in the paranormal field. So it's like when she had Grant and Jason on, and I was sitting at the break, and we were all talking at the break. Them guys cracked me up, by the way. They are hilariously funny. They really are, man. They are hilariously funny. And but they were telling me some of the stories that didn't make TV and stuff like that. They said some weird crap happened to them that sci-fi wouldn't let them put on TV.
Oh.
And they're not the only ones. I've had some other ones, you know, that talked about that. And then there's, you know, they do a lot of the psychics. And see, psychic research for us, because ICAR actually does psychic research, because, you know, for us, in order, and this is important, ladies and gentlemen, in order for us to even consider you to be an alien abductee or an alien contactee, you have to be empathic. You have to be. You have to at least be empathic.
That's interesting. How do you determine whether someone is?
Well, there's ways of testing it, and there's actually several different ways of testing it. But most contactees you can tell pretty quickly, because contactees, especially untrained ones, have a really bad way of either sending or receiving emotion. So you can take one, and you'll be walking into a group of people, and they might pick up somebody else's mood instantly. But a lot of times they'll transmit their own mood. So, you know, all of a sudden there'll be five people standing there chit-chatting, and they'll get really scared or really mad or really happy all at the same time, and you're like, what just happened there? Or all of a sudden the contactee will burst out into tears or burst out laughing for no reason at all. It's because they're experiencing someone else. But, you know, those, so we look for empathic is first, and telepathic. Some of them are I don't want to say clairvoyant, but they do seem to possess some clairvoyance, and some of them have telekinesis. And the best telekinesis I can say I've seen so far is I've seen someone lift the pen up with their mind and move it across a desk to the other side. I've seen a lot of bending of things, but I'm still skeptical about the bending of things. But the one that I've seen, the pen actually hovered across and went across and sat down in front of me, that one kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah, I bet.
Now, the telepathic ones, there's quite a few that are telepathic, that are very, very telepathic. You know, one of the things we do, usually we'll have one of the investigators that are very telepathic, we'll usually have them present at one of the ICAR meetings, or when we're bringing in new people, or interviewing supposable contactees or abductees. We'll usually have one or two of them present. That's why we try to do them online, because if we can do it online, we can have more than one or two present. And something we learned about 10 years ago, the Internet has a very strange way of amplifying telepathic abilities.
The Internet amplifies telepathic abilities.
And we're not the only one that says this. There's a lot of researchers out there that say this. And I'm not exactly sure why, but I'll give you an example. Like last night in the room. People, we're talking, right? I'm answering questions before they ask them. And then they're replying to the answers before I put it in the room.
Wow.
And this goes on quite frequently, and we've seen this literally hundreds of times across hundreds of areas, so we actually started putting it to the test. We will actually open up the room some nights, bring in a group of people, and one person will get there, and they'll send it. We use a control group, so one person will think about something, they'll send it out to three people, like if it's color red. They'll send it out to three of the admins, color red. And then all of a sudden, you'll see the text in the room, red, 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 5, 6, 7, 8 people down, red, red. So then we got more advanced. We started doing, like, sentences, like, how are you today? You know, something a little bit more complicated. All of a sudden, you'll see one or two people, how are you today? in the room. I mean, it's phenomenal to watch. It's even kind of a little scary sometimes. But there's some of them that are very, very, very telepathic and very, very.
Do you ever record this kind of thing? Like somebody was asking about the telekinesis, you know, when you talked about someone lifting a pen and moving it and setting it down without touching it.
The guy who actually did that, we actually tried to get him to go to, what's his name, the one with the $1 million? Y'all know who I'm talking about, Randy, what is the crazy guy's name? Anyway, we tried to get him to go do that, and they're like, no. And I got to say anyway, because I know someone else that went and did that. That was pretty, that was very, very telepathic. She read to Randy his like last 3 weeks of what he did, and Randy told her they had a spy following him around. That's how she knew. So he has no intention of giving up that money. And these are things that are almost impossible. So, you know, I was trying to get the guy to go over there and maybe levitate him off the ground. Just like, yeah, tell him how he did that. But it didn't happen. But some of the stuff we do record. There was a session we did. There was a girl under hypnosis, and she was talking about the reptilian. Actually, first she was talking about the grays and a click sound they make. And it was interesting because she was replicating the sound with her own voice. And it was just weird. It was just weird to dance to click things. Well, somebody had just watched Star Trek IV, you know, when they did the whale thing. So decided to stick it underwater, and it sounded almost identical to a dolphin. Almost identical.
Really?
It was really freaky weird, Karen. That still freaks me out today. I'm like, what the hell? So while we were doing this interview, we were interviewing some other contactees at the same time. Come to find out that they were actually part of a group that had actually seen dolphins on board one of the gray ships. And I've literally had hundreds of reports where they've seen ships hovering over water with dolphins sitting underneath the ships. And then a couple of them reported like the council meetings where they have there's a dolphin-like species present. I wouldn't call them dolphin, but we say dolphin-like. So there seems to be some kind of, I guess the grays have the ability to communicate directly. But for some reason, they're not using a telepathic communication. They're using a verbal, which until that moment, I didn't even know the grays could do a verbal conversation. I got to be honest with you. Until that very moment, I hadn't even heard of them being using any type of verbal communication. But whatever it is, we can't understand.
Well, that raises an interesting question. Actually, you know, in the first half, we were talking about ancient images of UFOs and ancient oral histories of people having seen these things. Well, there's also a very ancient tradition in, I believe it was one of the Babylonian religions, about a god who lived in the ocean and came up out of the water. And a lot of people equate him with a dolphin.
Well, that's the same thing with the Dogon. The Dogon.
Yeah, that's what made me think of it, and I wanted to bring it up then, but then the conversation didn't really
we kind of shift around. But see, that's the thing. The Dogon are very interested in that side, too, because they say their god's an amphibian. And what's funny about that is contactees today say the reptilians are not reptilians. They're warm-blooded amphibians. They say they kind of look like a reptile, but when you touch them, they're warm to the touch, and they have gills. They have gills, and the males have them in two places, the females and the females have them in two places, too. Sometimes you'll see them right at the back of the neck, right above the shoulder, but usually it's actually below the shoulder line. There's a set of gills back there, and that was kind of freaky. But we've seen in the drawings, the reptilian's feet and hands are webbed. You know, so they have webbed hands and webbed feet, and gills. It sounds like an amphibian. It doesn't sound like a reptilian. I mean, it can still be a reptilian even if it lives in the water, but I mean, it just, you know, the way they're describing it as amphibian, so. And that goes back in our society for as long as we've been around. And then there's the stories of the Sumerians when they talk about the two great white cities. They talk about this human-like race. They weren't human in the sense that like us, but they built these two great white dome cities, and they stayed in them. They couldn't come out of them. Apparently, they couldn't breathe the atmosphere on this planet. They say that race created another human race that came out, and it was just like them, except they could live on the planet. And they said that race got to milling around and decided, well, what the hell? We're gods, too. We don't have to do physical labor. Let's create another race. And then what's funny about that is there's the seven creations of man that the Sumerians believe in. What's funny about it is some of the creations happen to be things that you see on different places around the world, like the birdmen of stone of Easter Island, and the lion and horse, the lion and dog-headed men of Egypt. These are things that the Sumerians talk about long before these other two races were alive. And it's part of what they call the seven creations of man. Being the last creation of man was a human-like creation. But to make a long story short, at this point when they created this sixth or seventh race of man, they started talking about... it was interesting because when you read the Sumerian text, it talks about this race being kind of benevolent, meaning if you've ever read the Bible or the description of Adam and Eve, they could do stuff like they could plow the fields, they could make beer, they could name their kids, they could procreate. They didn't ask why they had to do all of this stuff. They were very submissive. They didn't care. Now, what's funny about that is they said the reptilians used to come in, steal their women, rape their women, and bring them back. And the kids were born, they said, were very different. They didn't look different, but they acted different. They were defiant. They wanted to know why they had to get up and plow the field. Why couldn't they go do this? Why couldn't they do that? And eventually that race overthrew the humans that were there. And this is all in the Sumerian text from start to finish. They talk about all this in great detail from one end to the other end. So they're talking about how the reptilian, and when you get into it, the human brain has a reptilian section in it. You can't even deny that when we have that reptilian section in our brain. That's just part of who and what we are. So, you know, now you have the Sumerians talk about it. Then you have the Dogons talking about it 1,500 years later. And then science today says, well, look, you have a reptilian section in your brain. So there's got to be some. And the other big clue to it is every major race on the planet has this human reptilian story. Even the Bible, the serpent is a reptilian. It's the snake.
And represented self-awareness, which fits right in with what you were saying about people changing from just being quiet and docile and doing what they're told and suddenly saying, well, why do I have to do that?
Yeah, the first thing Eve did was clothe herself because she realized she was standing there naked.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, she might have been good looking, but she's like, oh, no, wait a minute, I'm naked. Man,
of course,
it also
sounds like every kid that becomes a teenager.
Yeah, and it's you know, so it, what it is it's basically showing, you know, somewhere along the line there was these aliens that visit the planet today, these humans and reptilians, probably had something to do with our evolution. Whether it was the sole contributor, or whether they even put us here, or if we were some kind of race that they started dabbling with, and then the other one dabbled with, and then it created the race that's here today, is yet to be seen. But there's a lot of good evidence out there to suggest that there's been some interference with our evolution. And even mainstream science kind of borderlines on, you know, well, we don't really fit here, guys. Our bodies don't seem to really be designed for Earth, and our evolution here seems to be a little bit odd compared to everything else. And there's no real line of regression going back 63 million years like there is for everything else.
Yeah.
So, you know, science is kind of like, nothing that you can prove or you can argue about, but nothing that you can prove. But you do have these stories from all the ancient cultures. So when you have those, and then you have with the contact, these are saying from the day they kind of all fit together. And it does paint a picture that they have been here for a very long time, and in some shape, form, or fashion, they have been screwing around with our DNA and who and what we are, but not to the extent that they've been giving us technologies or anything along those lines, which I think is kind of cheesy, by the way. If they're going to mess with us, they could at least give us something for our troubles, you know. Maybe a way to get rid of hurricanes would be nice.
That would be nice, yeah.
You know, maybe a way to feed the starving, maybe a way to get rid of nuclear radiation. I don't know, something. Give us something, you know. Just throw us a bone, people.
Yeah. Now, Joe, since you were talking about the aliens, or the reptilian aliens, I wanted to ask, I know we mentioned, or you and I discussed a very long time ago, just in an aside, probably during one of the breaks on another show, that people have mentioned seeing reptilians in New Orleans, right where you are.
Yeah, now that was funny, right after, kind of scary, but kind of funny. This was about 10 days, 8 days after Katrina. It was real weird. I was at home. I was actually had been driving around that day, earlier that day, looking at some work and messing with some stuff. I got home that afternoon, and my phone rang. which was odd to start off with because there's nobody down here but a handful of us in the area anyway. You know, we actually broadcasted live the Wednesday after Katrina from my house in New Orleans, 3 days after the hurricane. But anyway, make a long story short, I get this phone call. Guy says he's from the National Guard, and that he had seen what appeared to be a reptilian, or actually three reptilian aliens, walking waist-deep water down Esplanade Avenue in the French Quarter. And I'm thinking, okay, you've lost your mind. He's like, no, I got two friends that were with me, two other National Guards. And he said, to boot, and he called me Mr. Mentaldo, which kind of freaked me out, and he said, to boot, there were four NOPDs present at the time, four New Orleans police officers. Now, what I found, first off, most fascinating about this is these things, these reptilians walked up on these guys. Now, these guys at the time were toting M16s. Not one of them, and I asked them point blank, did you swing your F-16 or point it at the alien or threaten the alien in any way? And he said, you know, I never even thought about my gun. So when I talked to him, when the NOPD called me, I asked him, you know, I said, because I know they're carrying 357s or 9mm or 45. I said, did you draw your gun? You know, I never thought about my gun. And they all told me the same thing. They got this weird feeling, this weird sense that came over them, and then the next thing they remembered, they were all either walking back down the street or walking back to their car, and nothing had happened. It was just really, really, really weird. Now, I've talked to one or two of them since then that have had some really rather strange dreams, but I don't think they were abducted. I think that the reptilians were just down there enjoying the deep water in the city, on the edge of the city, because the French Quarter didn't have any water in it, but on the edge right there on Esplanade, they did. And they just were out having a stroll when they walked up on the military. And apparently there were some really good telepathic abilities there because they didn't even take a shot at them, didn't even try to shoot at them.
Mm.
So that was weird. That was a weird thing. And for a long time, I was thinking, if I wouldn't have been able to verify that these people were actually in the military, and that these other guys were actually, two of them, I could verify that they were NOPDs. If I couldn't have done that, I wouldn't have believed the story, to be honest with you. But once I verified who they were, I was like, oh, no, this is definitely what it seems to be. Now, there was that, and then there was an earlier case a few decades earlier. Someone had said they had seen a reptilian near that same area, which I thought was kind of odd. I actually found that out after the fact. An old guy I know down here, I was talking to about it one day at the bank, of all places. Said, you know, Joe, back in the 1940s, they talked about an alien that came up out of the river and was walking down the levee right there in New Orleans. I'm like, huh? It was the first I had heard about that one. Like,
came up out of the river.
Yeah,
he said
he come walk. They said the witnesses seen him come walking up out of the river, get on top of the levee, walk down the levee a little ways, and then go down the other side of the levee and disappear into the city. And I was like, now, usually when you hear stuff about New Orleans, you hear about vampires or ghosties or something like that. Because there's a lot, you know, there's the old thing about the vampires live downtown New Orleans, and they don't kill you, and they don't convert you, but they like to get you at early in the morning, suck on your blood, and get high. You know, if you've been doing drugs, they can suck your blood and get high. You've been drinking, they can suck your blood and get drunk, stuff like that. You hear a lot of that stuff, and you know who started that was, what's her name? Anne Rice. That's who started that. Anne Rice is the one that started that.
Yeah.
I mean, it might have started
with
before.
The vampire and all of those.
Yeah, that's who I heard it from was Anne Rice. But it might have started before that. But those stories are funny. You know, you hear a lot of that stuff down here. You hear about, you know, ghosties walking down Bourbon Street or grabbing their girlfriend or wife and dragging them down the stairs or something, or door slamming in your face, or weird apparitions. And you know, New Orleans is one of the oldest cities in the country. And so you know you're going to have those. We like Nicolas Cage's house. Everybody and Mama wants to go investigate his house. They say his house is haunted beyond belief. And but he won't let anybody in there. He's like, no. But there's some really haunted houses down there. But a lot of that stuff, people are not going to let you into. It's private. You know, there are the ghost tours you can come down and take, and the vampire tours you can come down and take, and there's the haunted mortuary and places like that. But you know, that's what you usually hear about New Orleans. You don't usually hear about aliens or, you know, spacecraft. Matter of fact, the first time I made a report, actually Linda made a report to the local newspaper, they were so shocked they came out and did a full-page article on it. It's still to this day in the Times Picayune, a whole full page.
They were so shocked because it was about
we reported
UFOs
about aliens.
And aliens,
yes,
and
yes,
not about ghosts. And
not about ghosts. Even a girl said to me, she said, well, UFOs, I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Wow.
I was like,
isn't it interesting, though, that it's such a hot spot for all different kinds of activity?
Yeah, well, it's an old city. It's not the oldest city, I think it's third or fourth oldest city in the United States. It's mm-hmm. way up there, though. And now, compared to Europe, it's a baby city.
Well, right, but compared to America, there aren't that many.
Maybe
Philadelphia.
Yeah, because it was one of the first cities founded. And, everybody always thinks about the East Coast cities, but, they forget that Florida has got the oldest city in the United States in it, not the upper states, And people forget that sometimes, that the Spanish came here and settled here long before anybody else did. And, we always revert, but we don't really pay attention to what was what and who was what. We forget that they went to South America first, not to the United States first. And that's just because we're Americans. We want to think everything revolves around us is all that is.
Yeah.
But, it's an old city with a lot of weird stuff going on in it. And, matter of fact, you can go down there any given night, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and walk in between. Now, y'all listen before y'all come down here and do this. Before y'all come down here and do this. Don't ever walk through the city of New Orleans by yourself, okay? Just don't. It is not safe for many reasons.
And not only because of the ghosts and the vampires and
it
the
it is not a safe place to walk by yourself. Now, we always tell tourists to walk 3 or more, okay? Because if 3 or more is a crowd and you can make a lot of noise, they usually won't mess with you. 1 or 2 people, you're taking a chance of getting mugged or even killed in the city of New Orleans. It's a beautiful city. It's a very fun place to walk through at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I have done it many times. But even as big and as ugly and as scary as I am, I will not walk through the quarter by myself.
Wow.
Okay, and you can tell between a local and a tourist. It's quite easy to tell because locals don't dress like the tourists do. Tourists always overdress when they come down here, Locals, especially if it's fall or spring or summer, locals are usually in short pants. They're wearing the minimum amount of clothes they can wear
because
it is hot down there. And they have a different attitude about them, and you can just tell a difference. And, there's some bad people that go down and hang in a quarter. Not like it used to be before Katrina, but still, it's a dangerous place. And so we tell everybody, go with at least 3 people or more and enjoy it. If you go with 3 people or more, you're going to have fun. You're going to probably some weird stuff. A couple of years ago, we were down in Old Pirates Alley. Actually, it's the where they used to sell the slaves in between St. Louis Cathedral and the slave quarter, the old slave quarter. There's a group of buildings there where they used to keep the slaves, and then there's a cathedral right there. And this little alleyway between there is where they used to auction the slaves off and do some horrendous stuff from what I've been told over the years. Well, if you walk through there at like 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning and it's just a handful of you, you almost always experience something weird, man. Almost always.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to come down.
Freaky weird. I was walking through there one night and I was with some friends and they kept, you hear that? I said, I don't hear anything. Y'all cracking up. And I said, no, Joe, I'm telling you, someone's talking to us. I'm like, dude, there ain't nobody out here but us. Y'all been too much to drink. Calm your butt down.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sit down. They got these statues down here that look like they're alive. They make them to look like that. Like a girl sitting down, stretching her legs, another guy feeding the birds. But they're just bronze statues. But at night, it's hard to tell. And so we're sitting down here talking, and all of a sudden you hear, please don't sell me. And then it's first what you heard, please don't sell me, please. Then you hear them start screaming. It got loud enough that I got up and left.
Oh, wow.
And there wasn't nobody out there. I was like, well, time to go. I don't mess with ghosties. I leave them alone. I said, I'm not a ghost hunter. I ain't going to mess with the ghosties. They start talking to me. I'm leaving. Or I'm calling Tuesday.
I think it was New Orleans I was just reading about. There was one of the older cities, and I'm pretty sure it was New Orleans, where they said there are certain neighborhoods where the police are accustomed to being called out several times a night because people hear screams.
Oh, yeah.
Tourists
are
coming through
places.
And they hear screams and they call the cops.
There's places around the quarters, especially in the older parts of the city, because some of the city is much older than other parts is. And It's weird. And you will. You'll be going along and hear somebody screaming. At first you're thinking, oh, it's some crazy, you know, partying or acting like a fool or maybe somebody getting shot or something. But then you realize, you know.
You sound so casual. Oh, maybe it's just somebody getting shot. No big deal. Oh, my God.
You know, it's not the safest city. Just trying to be honest, right?
I guess Rochester's a lot more quiet than I thought it was.
You know, I love my city, and I'll never move out of it. And I'll always encourage people to come down. But any majorly big city, you should always be careful when you're walking in, and you should always be with friends because if it's an older city, there's probably going to be some high crime, like New York, D.C., New Orleans, mm-hmm. Los Angeles, places like that. Always have high crime rates. And you just want to be careful, and they like to pick on tourists. You know, but New Orleans itself is haunted. The whole damn city is haunted. You'll be sitting out there, like some days you'll be sitting out in front of Jackson Square, and that's where they park the mules and the carriages so you can go riding. And all of a sudden, the mules will just start whining and yanking and jumping and kicking because something passed through there. And you'll ask the guys in the car, oh, damn ghost coming through here, man, scaring the crap out of the mules. That always freaks me. And they do. They get crazy and antsy and start jumping around and stuff. And a guy was telling me just recently, I think it's either just before they close up down there, like midnight, 1 o'clock, he said it almost always, he said you even get this weird shivering sense that something just walked over your grave or passed through your body or something. And when you go down and interview a bunch of them people, they tell you the same thing. And then, you know, when you talk to the tarot readers or the witches down in there's a lot of witch covenants in New Orleans, and there's a lot of witches that hang around Jackson Square and all. When you get down there and start talking to a lot of them, they'll tell you some wicked stuff that goes on down there. They really will. They'll start telling you stories, make your hair stand up on your head, and you're going, okay, that's enough. I'm going home now.
Wow.
I'm going back to Metairie where there's no ghosties. Because I live about, as the crow flies, I live about a mile and a half from downtown New Orleans, but I live in the suburbs and where it's nice and safe and the people are pretty and behave themselves. Well, to an extent, anyway. We got like a minute. Look at this. I'm about to run us over again.
But it's not my problem this time because you're the producer. And
yeah,
you're
but I see Tuesday and...
See how I keep trying to put it on you, Joe?
I see Tuesday and Angela and they're going to give me the look. If I don't think I don't see y'all, ladies. I see y'all in the virtual auditorium. See, I see y'all.
I'm trying to watch... I actually just got bounced out of the chat room. I've been trying to log back in, but if anybody has any last-minute questions that they've been trying to send me, I apologize. I'm not able to read them.
Guys, really, I was coming on with Karen to talk about the X conference tonight. I got to rambling about a bunch of stuff. I don't get to talk to Karen for very long unless we're at conferences and stuff. But I will be at those arts. I will be in D.C. Come up to D.C., okay, guys, because the conversation is going to... I'm going up to Ozarks because I'm doing a little lecture up there, but I'm really going up to see Grant Cameron. I want to go spend some time with Grant and talk to him and torture him because he won't tell me what him and Stephen Bassett are up to. I've been on both these guys for like a year now. What are y'all doing? Because they'll come on my show and tell me, well, Steve and I are working. I'm like, oh, what? Well, we'll tell you later. I'm like, oh, I'm going to kill y'all suckers, man. Every time I see them now, I'm like, come on, fess it up. Fess up the secret. But y'all, if you can, come down and visit New Orleans. But really, I'll be in D.C. It's April 17th, 18th, and 19th. Come up, enjoy it. It'll be a good lecture. There's a lot of good people up there. Karen will be there. Richard will be there.
I will be there.
Come up.
Rich is speaking. I'll be there helping to sell books and DVDs.
She'll be picking on him while he's up there trying to do his lecture, making faces at him and stuff. And
yeah, we should be hecklers this time.
Yeah, you'll heckle.
I might actually bring the kids this time.
Oh, cool.
We're talking about bringing
nice
Mike
place.
And Elaine, so.
You know, I thought about bringing my grandkid, and then I said, no, I'll commit suicide after a couple of weeks. I'll leave him at home, but... I've got some Mill Labs coming up with me. I've got some contactees coming up with me.
Oh, cool.
And we've got some press people coming up. I think, there's two of iCar's directors will be there. There'll be three radio show hosts, I believe. There. Karen will be there, I'll be there, and Therese will be there.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so there'll be three radio show hosts. So we will be doing some live stuff there if we can get a few free minutes. But anyway, I'm going to shut up now because I can see Tuesday psychically telling me, Joe, get off the air.
I'm hearing these messages. Stop talking.
That's what I'm hearing. Prison going, shut up and get off the air. See, Angela's a sweet one. She's sitting there going, she's just tapping the foot. I wish she'd shut up. Anyway, I'll let you close this out so we can get out of here.
Joe, thanks so much for joining me. I really had a great time finally getting a chance actually to sit and talk and hear about your work and about what you've got coming up at the conferences. And to everyone who joined us this evening, thanks so much for being here. You've been listening to Through the Keyhole live on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Oh, yeah.